Howdy, hashtag AmWriting listeners. I can't wait to share this episode with you, an interview with thriller author Peter Swanson, in which we talk plotting and pantsing, terrifying children's books, and providing your narrator with some elements of your own story, but fortunately not entirely being your narrator. Whether you consider yourself a plotter or a pantser, we know you consider yourself a writer. Of course, you write, enough said. If you have plotted or pantsed your way all the way through any narrative, you know what a tough job that is, and you might be able to help somebody else do it, too. In addition to matching writers with book coaches who help you keep your butt in the chair, our sponsor, Author Accelerator, offers book coach training and certification. If that sounds like it might be the perfect gig for you, head to authoraccelerator.com to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone, trying to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is hashtag AmWriting, the podcast, the weekly podcast for writers about writing all the things, be they fiction, nonfiction, short things, long things, essays, proposals, pitches. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
And I'm Serena Bowen, the author of 30-odd romance novels, and our third, Jess, is off today traveling.
Traveling. I am KJ Delantonia. I am the author of the new novel, The Chicken Sisters, which you'll be able to buy in June 2020. And don't worry, I will remind you. And also the author of How to Be a Happier Parent, as well as the former editor and lead writer for the New York Times' Motherload blog. And I'm still a contributor there at the Times. So that's us. And we have a guest today. So before I let him talk, I will introduce him. Our guest today is Peter Swanson. He is the author of 6 novels, including his most recent 8 Perfect Murders, which Serena and I have both in Serena's case, read and enjoyed, and in my case, not quite finished, but oh my gosh, it's so good. Extreme fun there. His other books are The Kind Worth Killing, Her Every Fear. He's been an NPR Book of the Year, a New England Society Book Award, and he also writes things also about mysteries and thrillers, I have noticed. I've yet to find anything he wrote about anything else, including a series of sonnets based on Alfred Hitchcock's movies. And yeah, don't worry, we'll be getting into that. So Peter, thank you for coming. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're excited. And the question is always, where are we going to kick it off? I want to kick it off early in your career.
Okay.
As I said, I can't find any evidence of you writing about anything other than your love of mysteries or actual mysteries. So tell us about how you got started in the genre. I hate to imply that you're hero, your protagonist of your 6th novel. So come on, you wrote the autobiographical stuff a long time ago and probably threw it away. But your latest protagonist is a mystery lover, and it makes me feel, well, and clearly you are too.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually think that I didn't write the autobiographical stuff early in my career. I think Malcolm Kershaw, despite the circumstances of his life, is my most autobiographical character by far, just because his reading habits and his love of books is completely me. And also the way he got into reading as a young reader, which is me as well. I was definitely one of those kids that loved to read, but early on I knew anything I read needed to be a little bit creepy, a little bit dark, a little bit out there. And when I was a precocious reader. So when I turned 9, 10, I started reading my parents' books that they left lying around the house. I remember one in particular was Coma by Robin Cook.
Excellent choice for a 9-year-old. Well, pretty much bedtime reading, right?
Yeah, so disturbing. I learned so much from that book. and it was very disturbing, and it was terrifying to me too. I think I picked it up because I don't know if you remember the original cover of that book, but it was the sort of victim suspended on wires. I mean, it was a scary cover as well. But I think I got addicted to that terror, and I just became an adult reader who really gravitates toward anything in the mystery thriller genre. It doesn't mean I don't occasionally pick up something else, but, you know, it doesn't last long. I always go back.
Wow. That's such a great history, because your protagonist in Eight Perfect Murders is so convincingly a lifelong mystery fan. I just love that story.
Yeah. In fact, everything he says in the book about him as a reader is basically me as a reader. There was one brief period where I was like, I got to make him different and I'll have him like a few books I don't like or something like that. And then I just thought, oh, well, I'm not going to do that. I'll just make him me in that respect. And I want to make it clear for you've read the book that is the only way in which he is like me.
Well, we're happy to hear that.
We were making some assumptions. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did it feel good to sort of finally release your inner book lover into a protagonist?
I think it just felt good to write this book. And that's not always the case. I mean, you guys are writers, so you know that sometimes...
We just float through.
Oh, you do? It's all easy.
Yeah, Serena rides a unicorn while she writes, and I just, you know, squirt rainbows out of my pen.
That's amazing. I mean, you know, occasionally it flows, and it's fun to write, but most of the time it's a slog and it's hard, but we still do it anyway. This book had moments where it was hard and as well, but in general it was really fun, and I think one of the things that made it fun was it was so much about other books, vintage crime in particular, which is my passion, about being a reader. And then I just got to delve into a lot of reading myself, a lot of rereading, and just thinking about, you know, fictional murder.
It is amazing fun. And for anyone who did grow up as either thriller noir lover or a traditional mystery lover, I fall into the traditional mystery lover category. It's a fun read because it's got great plot, because it's got a great character or great characters, but also because of that. Books about books, I think many of us find those to be catnip.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love books about books anyway, and so it was really fun writing one.
That is such an enduring trope or archetype, the bookstore owner.
Right.
And it recurs in genre everywhere. It's wonderful.
Well, Peter has actually written a blog post about, ten best writers in thrillers? Thrillers about writers?
Yeah, I think
writers.
I did that a while, yeah.
It made me wonder if it was the origin story behind Eight Perfect Murders, because Eight Perfect Murders has at its heart a blog post about Eight Perfect Murders.
I don't think it was the origin story. I think, my origin story for this book was very strange, because most of the time when I come up with an idea for a novel, it comes in bits and pieces into my mind. And sometimes it's a long process. Sometimes I'm thinking about a book for a year or even longer. I'm slowly adding on to it. For this one, for Eight Perfect Murders, I actually remember exactly the moment it came into my head. I was out taking a walk and I was currently writing a short story. And I was trying to come up with a clever murder idea for the short story I was writing. So I started listing off in my head my favorite books that had really clever ideas for murders. And as soon as I had that thought, I was like, oh, I wonder if someone made a list of these and published them. And then immediately I was like, what if someone else took this list and actually started to commit real crimes with it? And there it was. I mean, the book was, that was the book. And I kept walking. I was actually walking around a pond. And I think I walked around it twice. And I just plotted the book on that walk. And it just kind of, it all came to me. So that by the end of the walk, I knew so much about this book, which is very rare for me. But I knew who the protagonist was. I knew he'd be an introverted bookseller. I knew who the killer was. I knew how all the relationships worked. I knew some of the books that would be chosen. I kind of knew the end. I knew it would take place in Boston, and I knew it would take place in the winter. It was really amazing experience, and it was great having all this. And it was also terrifying, because as writers, you know, there's a huge difference between having it in your head and getting it on the page. And having it all in my head was like, oh my God, now I want to write this book, and that doesn't happen overnight. So I was fortunate enough to be able to you know, write the book and get it close to what my initial, moment was.
Wow. So at the very beginning of you telling us this magnificent origin story for this book.
Which we envied.
Well, it's never happened to me before either. I mean, this is a one-off. Yeah.
Well, okay. You said...
I'll hold off for my sixth book, and Serena can hold off for her 36th book. We'll hope right. that six is a magic number.
You said that it was rare for you. And I guess I just always assumed that people who write, you know, very plot-driven, intricate, you know, stories of mayhem have to be excellent plotters ahead of time. Are you telling me that's a lie?
Yeah, I think actually there are still plotters out there. There's still crime writers, because I meet a lot of crime writers because they're my colleagues when I go to festivals. And there are still crime writers out there who plot it all out in advance and really think about reveals and when to reveal things and when to show clues and all that. But I think increasingly, and I'm definitely included in this category, in the technical scientific terms for these are plotters, of course, and pantsers. I'm a pantser.
Right.
A pantser is a writer who flies by the seat of his or her pants. I think increasingly number of thriller writers are like me, where generally what I get is a premise. And then I kind of build up the characters and I kind of think of the initial events that are going to kick off the story. And then I just start writing. That doesn't mean that I'm not thinking ahead and I often have where I want to reach, you know, the end goal, where I want to get to at the end. But in general, the middle is a big blank for me, and I just sort of meander through it.
Wow. Because my terror would be that you could actually write a murder and then not know who did it, you know, come to some place in the middle and be like, you know, I don't know if I can solve this one.
I think there are some crime writers who do that. I always know... That would be strange for me, because I think when I'm building up a story in my mind, and I always use this as advice for other thriller writers, if you're stuck, if you're in the middle of your story and you're having a tough time, you're painted in a corner, or you're having a tough time finding out what happens next, always go to the villain, always go to the criminal, because they're the one driving the story. So think about what's going on with them in their mind. Even if they're not the focus of your book, because they are the drivers. Without the crime, you don't have the book. So for me, the villain, the killer, and why they are a killer, and how they became a killer or a criminal or whatever, is to me this so crucial to the story. Like, what's their backstory? What's their motivation? How did they become this way? So I do always know who my bad guys are.
So talk about your choice to make this sort of this book is written in the style of a memoir,
yeah,
as though it is the memoir of the protagonist, and that's a really different choice than a third person or even a first person story. This is a protagonist who's very aware that he is telling the story, and that is it's an interesting and different approach.
Yeah, I in terms of third person and first person, and I've written. I think four of my books have been in third person and two of my books have been in first person. It's comforting to write in first person. I think most books should be written in third person unless you have a clear reason not to do it. So when I started writing this book in first person and he had this sort of chatty, he's aware that he's telling a story. And then I was like, yeah, he is telling this story. He's writing this down at a later date to get the facts out there. And that's sort of justified first person for me. And I think the other thing it allowed me to do was have a lot of fun with, he's in some ways a classic unreliable narrator. It's not so much lying as when he tells you what he wants to tell you. So he's telling the story completely from his perspective, and he's revealing facts at certain times. I wanted to sort of clue in the readers in advance and say, like, yeah, this is who he is. Like, you're not going to know exactly what's going on with this guy, and he's going to let you know this up front. I thought that was a really fun way to tell the story.
It was. I mean, it's very cool, because you know you're reading along and it feels fairly like it, it, it
you're gradually going, wait a minute. He's probably not telling us anything. Right. And just at the point when you're like, I don't think, he's like, I'm not telling you everything. And you're like, oh, not only is he not telling us everything, but he knows it. Like, we're going to know it together on this journey. And that to me was different. Because I love Anthony Horowitz. I've read the classic mysteries that sort of do something along these lines, but to have him actually be in on the mental process of his reader, that was different.
Yeah, I think, and that was something that didn't come to me on that original walk. I mean, I think when I was writing it, that came from his voice. And I mean, a lot of things come to you once you actually start putting the words on the page. And that was his voice. Once I started writing, was this almost confessional tone. And then I thought, well, that's what this book is. It's a confession. It's him presenting the facts. And that's, you know, once I knew that, then I had his voice. And I think that was really crucial in the process of putting this book together.
So I'm sitting here having all these very deep thoughts about unreliable narrators. Yeah. And I wonder about the choice. What does the author gain from writing an unreliable narrator? Because I would stipulate that it's harder. It's a harder thing to do, and you've pulled it off brilliantly. So what is the payoff for making this task more difficult for you?
Well, I will suggest that in 99% of cases of books in which there is a narrator, that a first-person narrator, that narrator is unreliable. In the same way that we as human beings, we're all storytellers because we're always telling the story of ourselves to ourselves. So we're narrating our lives, and I actually think we're unreliable narrators. We see our lives in different ways through our own eyes. And so I actually think that's what's interesting about first-person narration. So in my book, there's very clear cases of there's some facts he reveals to you later than he should. So that's classic unreliability. But he's also telling every narrator is refashioning the story with them as the lead, so that if this story was told, for instance, by the FBI agent who shows up, and it very easily could have been, an FBI agent comes and alerts him to the fact that someone might be using his list. Her name's Gwen. She could tell the story, and it'd be a very different story. But it wouldn't necessarily even be reliable because it would be her story. So I think that's my first thing. That's a little bit of me trying to get out of having to ask the question that you just answer the question that you just asked me of mm-hmm. what why you choose to do that. I just think it happens naturally. But I also love in the thriller genre in particular to have it's all about misdirection of the reader, because ultimately what you're trying to do is surprise them along the way. With the narrative of the story. So if you have a narrator doing this, it just helps it along. So I think that's why this choice is being made more and more. I think it really works. I think it's at the height of its popularity now, and there's a lot of thriller books out there with unreliable narrators, and at some point it will slightly change. But I do love it as a device.
I love it as a reader. You did a great job of it, and it's fun. And I love that you're pointing that out. And I think many of us, as we write, in whether we're third personing or first personing the voice of our protagonist, forget that the protagonist is, like you said, necessarily unreliable. I love that. That's going to be my favorite takeaway, I think, from this interview, because you're absolutely right. We are all unreliable narrators. It's perfect.
Of our own story, yes. Specifically of our lives, and that's what a first person is doing. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, this is just my sort of idle curiosity, but I noticed that the book has a different title in the UK. It's called Rules for Perfect Murders, and it's titled after the name of the blog post, which is 8 Perfect Murders. I wondered, is the book actually different? Does the blog post in the UK version of the book also have a different name, or did they just change the title?
They just changed the title. I mean,
got it.
And titles are a funny thing. I mean, you know, before I was a published author, I always thought, oh, authors pick their titles. Of course they don't. They do sometimes. I mean, you can be lucky enough to pick your own titles, but usually the editor comes back at you having heard from the sales team that they would like a slightly right. different title. And in this case, just the sales team in the UK and the sales team in the US had a slightly different feeling about which would sell more. They did, my editor in the UK did briefly say, oh, I wonder if we should change anything in the book or change the list title, but we left it as it was. So they're identical except for title.
I really want to ask about writing a series of sonnets exploring Alfred Hitchcock films. Can you just tell us how that came about and what it was like to do?
Yeah, so so I've always been a writer of short stories, and poetry was sort of how I got my start. And poetry is my other love besides mystery fiction. I don't write much poetry now. I hope to take it up again at some point. But a few years ago, I had been writing some sonnets, and I wrote one about the film version, Alfred Hitchcock's film version of Rebecca, based on the Daphne du Maurier novel, with an unreliable narrator, of course, who never even gives you her own name. But anyway, I wrote this sonnet. I was happy with it, and it just sort of, I was like, oh, maybe I should do more sonnets about Alfred Hitchcock films. And then I thought, well, what if I did a sequence, one sonnet for each of his films? He made 53 films in the course of his career. And I was like, well, that sounds like the right length. And, you know, it was fall. There was a long winter ahead of me. And I thought, well, this will be a great winter project. I like any project that means I can be watching a movie and calling it work, which is actually what, for A Perfect Murders, I spent a lot of time rereading classic crime and calling it work. So this is what I did. I watched all his films, which was really interesting to do that, and then kind of came up with an imaginative sonnet for each, often a persona poem in the voice of one of the characters. So it was a great project. It was a lot of fun. I hope to get back to poetry one day, but right now I'm having so much fun writing books that we'll see what happens.
Well, I think that the sonnet project is a perfect example of, I mean, you came up with, it's not like some editor came to you and said, you know what we really need?
What we really need?
Sonnets about Alfred Hitchcock's movies.
Yeah, so, strangely enough, no one came to me, and no one's come to me since I've written them saying that, so, yeah.
But you did place some of them. Some yes. of them have appeared places.
Yes. A bunch of them have. Yeah, have done well. But I'm still waiting for that call about the complete book. Hint, hint.
Well, I just think that's it's the perfect example of something being, you know, your own very niche-y passion, to which a lot of people would be like, oh, come on, nobody's interested in that besides you.
Right.
Or maybe, actually, no one would actually say that to you, but your internal voice probably does.
Oh, my internal voice tells me that all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Our internal voices are deeply, deeply evil. But other people are interested in it. So I love that as an example of, like, please, just if you got something you feel like you got to get out, get it out.
Yeah, I think as a writer you need to, and I definitely went through a little patch as an unpublished thriller writer where I did write a book that, the only book I've ever written and it was never published, was that felt to me like I was trying to write something that could be published. That I sort of came up with a concept that felt commercial. And I think in general, a lot of my voice tells me, well, that's too niche or too, or even this book. I mean, it's a lot of it is about sort of obscure crime fiction, but I think as a writer, you need to listen to that inner voice that's slightly weird and allow it to come out, because I think that's personality and people, you know, personality in books is good.
I wanted to ask you, Peter, it seems to me, and I haven't read all of your earlier work, but the earlier novels seem to be more in a classic psychological thriller vein,
yeah.
whereas this is kind of like psychological thriller meets classic whodunit. Is
yeah.
that, was that an intentional shift? Is it a move you're kind of hoping to make? Do you hope to do it again? You know, what's behind that?
Well, I think what was behind it was when I started to construct the book, I realized that this book is, you know, referencing these classic whodunits, that it would make sense that the book itself have some of those tropes in them. And I think mm-hmm. you're right. I think this does have a psychological thriller at its heart, but it's also structured much more like a whodunit. In fact, it's got, you know, a cast of suspects, because Malcolm realizes early on that whoever's doing these killings is probably someone he knows. And he doesn't know that many people. So there's a cast of suspects. There are definitely red herrings. There's definitely clues dropped in along the way. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a reveal of the killer. I mean, there are all these things that I don't normally have in my books. I've written a lot of books where, in fact, we know who the killer is, like, right up front in the first chapter. So it was a lot of fun to do that. I don't think it's a shift. I mean, I think I'd like all my books to be slightly different, but it definitely mm-hmm. felt like in this book, it was appropriate that I include some of the elements that I was also writing about.
Well, as a reader, I loved it because I'm actually not a psychological thriller reader, but I grew up as a very passionate classic mystery reader. So
Agatha Christie.
Of course, the ones to me that you missed would be Dorothy Sayers and Marjorie Allingham, but I suppose that's a conversation for a different podcast.
Yes, it is. We can go down that. I did kind of miss them. I realized that, but I like Marjorie Allingham, and I'm sorry to say, less enthralled with Dorothy Sayers. Just for whatever reason, those books don't do it for me as much. Some do, but I forgive you. I know. Well, you probably don't, but that's okay.
No, but I'm not necessarily. Patricia Highsmith is a little, I'm not always there for her. So it's
understandable. It's okay. Actually, she's a weird taste. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think we're.
We can all coexist.
We can agree. To disagree on that one. Yep. But, you know, I think you reach the readers that you've got that are established with your psychological thrillers, but readers like me who might not have picked up something that felt more like it was going to be that kind of stressful read, but do like the mystery element, are gonna be appealed, you know, this is going to work for them, so...
Hopefully,
that's
yeah.
kind of just fun. If for those of you listeners that are out there wondering, is this a book for me? There you go. That's my take on it.
Good.
I'm having more deep thoughts about how different a job it is to serve those readers who like to find a dead body in the first chapter.
Right.
Versus those readers who are perfectly fine with never seeing one anywhere in the book.
Right. Right. I write books where bodies are found in the first chapter. And there are some of my books. I mean, I definitely write on the darker edge. Not this one is my, I think in some ways my least dark, but,
wow.
I have friends who, it's funny. I have friends who are like, I don't like scary books. And they're like, and then they read mine and they tell me how it kept them up all night. And I'm like, you don't have to read my books if you don't like. I mean, not every book is for everyone, obviously. So, and I have a certain style. But I'm
well.
Yeah, go ahead.
I love the idea of you coming to this early. And I noticed in your back matter, you credit the used bookstore that your protagonist also likes, the Book Swap store.
Yeah. So Annie's Book Swap. Was there were a bunch of them around, I think, in the 80s and the 90s, and that was a franchise opportunity. So I think if you wanted to be a used book, I think it's still out there, actually. If you want to be a used bookstore seller, you could franchise in, and they would send you the sign, and they would tell you what you need and give you how to price your books and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all called Annie's Bookshops, but they were all independently owned. And there was one near me, and I think they were primarily focused on selling mass market paperbacks. So they had a huge romance section, huge mystery thriller section, huge sci-fi section, and they were kind of like beach books. And there was one near me, like there is one near Malcolm, the character in the book, that I started going to when I was young and spending a lot of money buying books that looked good to me, either because it was an author I knew I already loved, like Agatha Christie or John D. MacDonald, or it was just a cover that looked exciting. And, you know, that's what those covers used to do. They always had these sort of lurid covers that, especially to like a 13-year-old boy, looked like a lot of fun. So yeah, I just read everything. It was you know, my early passion.
Well, we have a complete set of the John D. MacDonald, Travis McGee mysteries at home. So as I was reading your, my husband discovered them at the same age that you did, I believe.
Yeah.
And so I was very familiar with that art that you describe in the book. And then it made me realize that I have this vivid memory of standing with my younger son when he was 4 years old in the picture book section of the library. And he's holding my hands and looking around at all the bunny art or whatever. And he says, "Mama, where are the scary books?"
Oh, my God. There he is. There it is. That's me.
Exactly. I thought, oh, so you're one of those.
Yeah. You know,
because there is no scary section in the picture books.
There's one. I take it back. I beg to differ. There's one. It's called The Book That Eats People. And when my youngest was very small, we had to hide it. And when my husband wanted to torment him, he would put it in his bed at night. Because, we're really good parents around
here. It's really funny. It's like it goes, you go one of either ways. I think the scary picture book for me, I mean, Where the Wild Things Are is kind of scary.
Oh, I was terrified of that as a child, actually.
It has a really haunting quality.
Read it to me.
Yeah, because the parent leaves the room and the room turns into this jungle full of monsters. I mean.
You know what else is scary? Sylvester and the Magic Pebble. I hate that book. It's terrifying.
It's terrifying. I had that book as a kid. It's also, it's scary in a different, it's scary in a very emotional way because it's so funny. You just said that. I haven't thought of this book in, I mean, how many years? And it's instantly back there because that scene where his parents are looking for him and he's right there as a pebble and they can't see him. Is just.
You only have to read that once.
It's like a nightmare. I mean, it's like a child's nightmare brought to life. But again, I like that book. So I like the nightmare stuff.
Yeah, I guess I like the overtly creepy. I like the book that eats people. Maybe the nightmarish ones are a little too possible. I like them. I like them to be
a little more
clearly fictional.
Right, clearly fictional. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I want. Well, this is a great place to segue into what we have been reading lately.
Okay, great.
And I think I will, I've got something else, but I'm going to say outright that both Serena and I really did enjoy 8 Perfect Murders.
Thank you so much.
If anybody is looking for a travel read or an at-home read or any kind of read, this is, and you know, you don't have to be a lover of thrillers or even of mysteries. This is one of those things that I think is going to please a lot of readers.
Great. Thank you.
I think so, too. I loved it so much. And my other book from this week is called Bringing Down the Duke by Evie Dunmore, which is effectively a historical romance written by somebody who loves Jane Austen. And I had a terrific time with it today when I should have been doing my revision.
One of our other guests mentioned that a few weeks ago, and I was eyeing it. And now I'm going to go and download it. Well, mine is completely different. Not fiction. I'm reading a couple of really good books, but I'm not done, and I want to make sure the author sticks the landing before I tell you guys about it. But I've really been enjoying Matthew Dix's Storyworthy. Matthew Dix is a very hard name to say, but Matthew Dix is a 36-time Moth Story Slam champion. He's told some really hysterical moths, if you are a fan. And this is a whole book about storytelling, but more, not surprisingly, more audio, you know, more talking kinds of storytelling, but also just telling yourself your story of your life. And I guess being a slightly more reliable narrator, or maybe a narrator that you would like to be, the heck with reliability. I don't know. My point is just that it's fun. It's a good read, and I'm getting a lot out of it.
Good. And I will, first off, I'll say my wife just read Bringing Down the Duke. So it's been,
really?
It's been sitting around my house and I've been looking at it, but, and she enjoyed it too, but I have not read it myself. And you know, of course the reason why is because there's no one dead in the first chapter. my book pick, and I read it fairly recently. It's actually out next week. It's a new book called My Dark Vanessa. It's a debut novel by Kate Elizabeth Russell. It is not a thriller, although it reads in a sense like a thriller. It has that suspenseful feel. It is about a dark topic, which is a relationship between an older man and a student in a private school. And the voice of the book is telling the story from when she's in her 30s, reflecting back, because she has always remembered this affair as more of a romance, and now she's beginning to wonder if it was something else. And talk about, like we have talked about, narrative, how her narrative of her own life is changing as she's reflecting back. It's a really,
that's a really, really interesting topic.
It's an amazing debut. She does a great job, and I think it's going to be a big book, and it comes out next week.
Cool.
Wow.
Well, by the time you hear this, listeners, it'll be out, because that takes us a little while to
go. I need to remember that on podcast.
It takes us a little while. We are not recording live.
That's great.
Someday, maybe. But yes, so by the time you hear this, you can definitely go grab My Dark Vanessa, because it's going to be out. Well, I just want to say thank you so much, Peter. This was great. Everybody, you can find more about Peter Swanson on his website, peterswanson.com. Do you hang out on any social media sites, Peter?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram, and I, of course, have a Facebook page. I think the easiest way to get to find out where I am is to go to my website, which is peter-swanson.com, and then there's like the contact, and it has all my Twitter and Instagram feeds.
Perfect. I'm glad you gave me the hyphen, because I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I just Googled you, and there you were. I'm not sure. We don't really need the direct web addresses so much anymore. We just sort of barf out, I don't know, his name was Peter, and the book had 8 in the title. Seriously, if you went to Google and were like, author Peter 8... murder, body.
Right.
You get it.
You get it.
You get it. Exactly. And I love that. I love that
about
Uncle Google. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you, Uncle Google. Let's see. What else? As always, if you like the podcast, please head over and leave us a rating and review somewhere where my phone isn't ringing. And you can download the show. My phone is still ringing. I've unplugged it and it's still, it's a dead phone and it is still ringing. You can download the show notes for this episode, which will include a transcript and the show notes for every other episode at amwritingpodcast.com, where you'll also find information about supporting the podcast, about supporter minis, about writer top fives, and all the other things that we are doing that we have managed to remember to get into the website.
All right.
You want to take us out, Serena?
I will. Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save. Pause. Stop. Thank you.